Welcome to Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Many scientific experiments are planned in excruciating detail. Other research projects are completely unplannable, resulting from chance meetings or even mistakes. The U.S. Array project is a combination of both. The Array refers to hundreds of seismometers that over the course of the past decade have been deployed in a rolling wave across the continental U.S. Such a project requires an enormous amount of logistical planning, not to mention funding and labor. U.S. Array was designed to answer questions like, what is the structure of the Earth's crust, at least the portion that lies beneath the United States, and what are the physical processes that control earthquakes and volcanoes? But the Array has generated a vast quantity of seismic data, and it's all freely available. That treasure trove hasn't gone unnoticed. Scientists outside the U.S. Array project have found a number of other unexpected ways to use both the moving collection of instruments and the data they produce. Researchers and organizers of the U.S. Array project gathered in Woods Hole earlier this fall to celebrate reaching the East Coast and to share what they've learned so far. I caught up with a number of the participants, starting with Bob Busby, the Transportable Array Manager. He pulled out his iPad and showed me a map of the United States with a swath of tiny red dots migrating across the country.
This shows that we started in the western U.S., installing seismometers here at a rate of about 10 or 15 per month. And we moved throughout the region, north in the summertime, south in the wintertime, and have been migrating these stations all the way across the country from west to east. We don't have enough instruments to leave them continuously in place and install a complete array across the whole country. So we do a scan, much like a fax scan when you fed a piece of paper in and the thing makes an image. This makes an image of the structure underneath the crust of the U.S. As these instruments go across. So they sit in a place for about 2 years and build up the structure in terms of seismic velocities, which geologists infer to be rock type or where plate tectonic slabs may have been. So that's part of the research. The operational aspect is to move this whole thing clear across the country. One of the things that people don't realize is that when there's an earthquake, it causes the ground to move throughout the whole country. Even a small earthquake like the one in Virginia is shown here with this the location of the earthquake. And you can see waves moving across the location of our stations in that particular time was in the middle of the country. And you can see a curvature of the waves moving much like ripples on a pond. It looks almost exactly like ripples on a pond. And so that's the way that we use to locate where the earthquake was, how big it is, and this the structure of these propagating waves tells us a lot about the structure underneath the continent right there in that location. So that's a very simple earthquake, a small one, magnitude 6 or so, in a crustal region. A very large earthquake has a completely different picture, and this is one of the things that's most fascinating for the public generally. When we show these movies, I gave a presentation out at the National Seashore a couple of weeks ago where we talked about their participation, the National Park Service, in hosting some of these stations and their interest in conveying science to the public. The Park Service interpreters are quite good at explaining science to the public. And we showed them this movie, which is a movie of the Array recording the big earthquake in Japan in March of 2011. And in this movie, you can see that the ground moves in the middle of the country for nearly 2 hours with these waves propagating through. And you can imagine this as a sort of sloshing of the Earth's surface in a very complicated but fascinating way.
I mean, the waves don't necessarily look like they're going just in one direction.
That's right. In fact, you'll see in a few minutes that the waves start to turn around and go the other way. And this is because the waves first come around, like the short course between Japan and the U.S. over the North Pole. And then waves come the long way around through Australia and up from the south. And you can see them moving back. And then the whole Earth becomes involved as it starts to throb and pulse. And this pulsing actually lasts for months. In this case, the ground motion is measured here by our array for about 2 hours of moving around constantly. So it's this kind of density of stations and the geographic coverage that lets us give a very detailed picture of the structure here. If you have a few isolated stations out here, you can certainly detect the earthquake, but it doesn't give you near the comprehensive picture that you can see in the structure of these waves moving around. So that's the importance of such a large group of stations occupying a large geographic region. You get a much better picture of the geology, and we can start to do some fascinating things by using mathematical techniques to back project the signals and study the very source of the earthquake, the rupture off Japan. And Miyake Ishii from Harvard has a presentation this afternoon that talks about the technique and the movies that you can make of the source ruptures. So we can study, even in the U.S., with these stations occupied in a certain region, very large earthquakes that occur anywhere in the world and how that rupture might propagate.
So what are these other slightly more isolated dots that are on there? Are they part of the EarthScope project, or are those more permanent arrays?
These are actually legacy stations where we have, instead of removing our station, either the state geologist or the state itself has paid to keep the station operating, or in some cases the USGS. So our stations were operating in Utah when the Crandall Canyon mine collapsed, and the mine itself was proposing that this was due to an earthquake, but our stations around there clearly showed that it was a mine collapse from the mining technique that they use. As a result, the state mining agency paid for those stations to stay there and monitor additional mines for additional safety. In Pennsylvania, some stations are being left because the state geologist is interested in continuing to monitor for background earthquake seismicity related to a lot of the fracking and gas development in that region. Similar interest in the upstate New York region. Our stations were located in Arkansas and Oklahoma when several earthquakes occurred there that were related to injection wells associated with fracking. So it has proved to be an observational technique that has value outside of the basic research in earth structure or even earthquake ruptures, but has some practical value in just determining, well, is this an effect that we need to monitor or pay attention to, and how big is it? These earthquakes that are related to injection wells are very small, magnitude 4s, something like that. They don't generally shake your house down, but they can affect the premise which was put forward in establishing the injection wells. That is, that the fluid is pushed below a cap rock that is isolated from the aquifer. But when that cap rock fractures in an earthquake, the premise that it's isolated is now gone. And so it's an important thing to study. It wasn't an original part of this research, but it has come along as a development that people are now paying very close attention to.
So presumably a transportable seismic station is different, perhaps smaller, than a permanent seismic station might be. Are there things that the transportable array cannot do that a more permanent station might be able to do?
They don't have as comprehensive of instrumentation, so ours is designed to be portable. It's fairly small, fits in a compact tube that's, well, it's not that compact, but it's about 6 feet tall and maybe 4 feet wide, and is buried into the ground about 8 feet deep. But a more permanent station typically has associated with it meteorological instruments. It has maybe some other gravity measurements, and so those are important for other types of studies. And our group does have a cooperation with the USGS that operates a global seismic network that is for permanent monitoring. There are a few stations in Massachusetts, notably up near Harvard, Mass., outside of 495, where one of the permanent stations existed for many decades now. And those are really a key aspect of global monitoring. That's what feeds data into the USGS facility in Golden, where you hear on the news this is reported as a 6.5 in somewhere. Those stations are fed directly into that facility and provide that information. These are only slightly less capable. The seismometers are just as good. But the deployment is a little bit more speedy, so we can't always choose the very best location. We choose out-of-the-way places in the corner of farmers' or ranchers' fields. It's not ideal. It's not dug into a rock or a cave or something like that, which would take some weeks to prepare for a permanent station. We don't have that kind of time. So in that sense, the quality is a little bit compromised, but we've got a system that works quite well and is very adequate for most states, increasing their monitoring and improving their capabilities. So it is a good technique.
So how do you choose the locations for these? You've got 1,700 in the ground at any given time, right?
We have about 500 operating at any one time. Overall, we've had 1,700 stations throughout the project, so we move them out of places after a couple of years. I'm sorry, I forgot your...
How do you choose where you're going to put them?
So initially, this project, the scientists wanted to image at a grid spacing of about 40 miles. Every 40 miles in a kind of square-like pattern, they would put a station. And so we began a calculation. Okay, start here and just mathematically decide where the next point is. Of course, we can't get that precise in finding the exact location. So we draw a circle and say, well, anywhere within, say, 15 miles of that would be suitable. And we then developed this criteria of free from vibrations, not near train tracks, freeways, pipelines, outside of major corridors of activity. We actually work with students from local universities, and we would go to those universities, teach a local faculty, and a couple of students would have a great job 10 weeks in the summer. They would drive around and look for places that were met the criteria, and then they would have to do something that's fairly challenging, go up and knock on the door of the landowner and explain the science project and ask them if they would be willing to host one of these stations. And it's surprising how many landowners, once learning that this is a university project, it's not a commercial enterprise, are quite willing to help, eager to participate in a science project, even if they don't understand exactly why, they find it interesting. And this is, I think, one of the best parts of the project, is to encounter so many willing people to help out on the project.
So my husband's uncle is actually one of the people who currently has one of these in his backfield in a farm up in Maine, and he was very excited when he was first contacted by the students who came to his house, and he had some funny questions, things like, what would happen if we went and jumped on it once it was installed? I mean, does that totally screw up your data? And
it doesn't screw it up. It adds a signal which we don't understand for a few minutes, and that doesn't really affect the long-term contribution to the project. That is, a few minutes of spurious vibration, which a farmer might produce in the normal activities or even just for fun to see what happens, doesn't really affect it. But people are quite proud of their stations. We give them a website where they can see the signals, and it will pull out the whole day's activity, and so they jump on the station and run inside and look at their computer and can see that thing. And it's interesting. You can't really have one up on your neighbors if you tell them that you have a seismic station in your backyard.
Not a competition that I think is terribly common.
I think I'm the only one in Falmouth.
Quite possibly. So could we actually take a look at the array over here, maybe get a little explanation of what's going on in there? I have to say, when I first looked at it, it looks almost like a porta-potty until you look more closely.
This is one of my neighbors inspecting the seismic station. So this is one of the instruments that we use to perform the whole array. We go to a site, we dig a hole about 7 feet deep, and we bring this high-density polyethylene tank. It's a modification of an underground cistern, and we pour a small amount of concrete in the bottom of this freshly dug hole. We balance this tank in the bottom of the hole, so it's now flush with the ground, or maybe sticks out about 6 inches, but extends into the ground 7 feet. Inside of this tank, we pour a layer of concrete that's about 16 inches. That's mostly for weight, to hold the tank into the ground with enough weight to, in case water comes or whatever, it'll stay stuck in the ground. We backfill over the tank and then cover it up. So the tank acts as a shelter. Inside the tank, we put seismometer in the very bottom. So it's a seismometer is about a basketball-sized instrument. It has small pendulums inside, which are very carefully balanced on springs and hinges, so that they can detect the ground movement in any of three dimensions, up and down, north to south, east to west. And these motions are very carefully monitored by a set of electronics that record the motions, and they forward that data on through a digital link, usually a cell phone, onto our facility in San Diego. So at the San Diego Supercomputing Center, we have a computer sitting there collecting data from all of these stations, 400 or 500 at a time. We send 5 or 6 gigabytes a day of data across the cell phone network. We have a big cell phone bill, so it's quite interesting. Also inside of the tank is some power, so we have some batteries which provide power either at night or in the wintertime. The batteries are charged by some solar panels that we put up nearby within about 20 feet of the station. And let's see, some other features of the station, which came a little bit later than the original plan, was to add infrasound and barometric pressure sensors to the station. We discovered that our station is quite sensitive to pressure variations, and that we can actually correct for this if we monitor the pressure. That turned out to be of interest to the atmospheric scientists and the people who monitor weather, because we have a very good grid with perfectly timed data down to a microsecond or so that's spaced at these even 40 miles across the country. So they began to make movies themselves of the pressure variation and so on. So it was an add-on experiment, came along about halfway through, but has proved to be quite an interesting research development in and of itself. We added it to basically do a signal correction on our data.
So you're one of Bob's neighbors?
Yes, I'm just a neighbor, but I'm also an oceanographer. So I'm interested in this, although it's not my field, it's his field. But what keyed my original interest is that he actually has one of these in his backyard.
Have you ever gone on over and jumped on it?
Oh, well, I haven't jumped on it, but he says he can see trucks coming, he can measure trucks coming up and down the road, and also he can measure windstorms. The movement of trees apparently is enough to cause a signal to come into these.
Is that just the roots of the trees moving underground, essentially?
Yeah, the tree's swaying. It's a big mass overhead, and it causes the ground to tip. So, we usually try to sight them outside of trees in open fields and so on, but I prefer my trees in Falmouth.
So what kind of other maybe odd signals have you guys picked up that turned out to be really interesting things? I mean, you can see trucks going by, you can see trees swaying, you can see changes in atmospheric pressure.
Well, one of the more interesting ones was last Valentine's Day. There was a big meteor which hit the atmosphere over Russia, and that actually produced a very large boom, blast in the atmosphere, one of the largest recorded in the last 50 years. Since the days of the Bikini Atoll and the nuclear blast. And this propagated in the atmosphere a pressure signal completely across the poles and swept down through the east coast of the U.S. Took about 8 hours to go across to that region, and then 2 more hours to cross from New York down to Florida. It was a very interesting signal. It was picked up on both the seismometers and on the pressure signals, and the correlation of the two, the comparison between the two, was quite interesting for both earth scientists and atmospheric scientists to see how those are related. So that's unusual to have both measurements at the same time.
If you came up with a slightly different housing, could you actually put these into the seafloor?
You could, actually. That was one of the ideas that's been bandied about. More tricky in the sense that you have a lot of water on top of the instrument, so you don't get very many chances to fix it if it's broken, so it takes special care in engineering the package. But Woods Hole is obviously a leader in ocean bottom instrumentations, particularly for seismometers, and we have some ideas for taking this project completely across the Atlantic with 1,000 stations going about every 100 kilometers and imaging the whole mid-Atlantic ridge from the western side where we are to the eastern side in Europe. And that's a fundamental structure on the planet, the mid-Atlantic ridge. Why does it span all the way from Antarctica clear up into the Arctic Ocean? And why has it persisted despite both opening and closing twice, it's not a very well understood feature in terms of the convective properties in the mantle and how it works mechanically. So that would be a very interesting experiment.
Bob, I understand you have GPS technology on the ground in association with these. Have you been able to measure movements of the continent either up and down or horizontally?
So there's a parallel project as part of AirScope, which does precision GPS. So they use multi-channel GPS stations, ones that surveyors use, 12 channels of frequencies built together, and they can locate the antenna within about a millimeter. And they actually operate these antennas on quite elaborate monuments for years at a time and can readily measure the motion of the plate tectonics, which is about an inch a year. And they have done so for the past 5 or 6 years. And this, the key aspect of that project is to really study how does the shape of the continent deform in regions like Cascadia or Southern California. They have about 1,000 instruments in quite dense spacing right along the compression zone, and to try to study how this compression works. That project is called the Plate Boundary Observatory. It's another portion of the AirScope project.
Are there, you know, so this basically gives you an underground map of the United States. Are there things that could be learned by doing this in other parts of the world?
There certainly is. In China, they're basically duplicating the experiment with their own money and their own research. They've sent people over to discuss with us the operational and equipment aspects of that, and we collaborate with them a certain amount. Europeans are trying to do a similar thing, although it's a bit more difficult. There's lots more national boundaries, and the national cooperation is not as cohesive as it is in the U.S., but other places are trying to do a similar thing. There's an effort, a nascent proposal out to try to do these large arrays and keep them in place in at least 5 parts of the world so we can image different aspects of the globe on a continuous basis with a large array, and putting the array, say, in Argentina, Australia, Africa, and trying to get the mutual project going in each of these international countries. That's a challenge politically. From a technical standpoint, it's just possible. So it's mostly a question of putting together the scientific rationale and getting the funding.
Speaking of funding, what does a project like this cost?
This project has so far cost, going from the West Coast to now, about $90 million. It costs about $9 million a year for us to do this project. It's expensive. We think the return is fairly good. This data that we produce is actually used by nearly every university in the country. More than 150 universities in the U.S. have graduate students and professors who do research in seismology and geology, and they can download this data for free. In fact, anyone can download the data for free. So we think it has a lot of return to the scientists.
That was Bob Busby, Transportable Array Manager for the U.S. Array Project. We'll talk with some of the scientists using U.S. Array data after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We now return to the U.S. Array Project reception, where I spoke with Dr. Maureen Long, Assistant Professor in Geology and Geophysics at Yale University.
The AirScope project was sort of just really getting going, kind of as I was finishing up my graduate work. And so when I started my my postdoctoral work, all of a sudden there was all this AirScope data there to use. And so I got involved with it, you know, sort of at that point, as the data set was really starting to become available. And all of a sudden there was all this really exciting science to be done with AirScope data. So it came along at a really good point in my career for me.
So what kinds of things are you doing with the data?
Yeah, so I work, I use transportable array data, so the U.S. Array transportable array data, and I work on measuring something called seismic anisotropy, which is a fancy way of saying that seismic waves actually go at different speeds depending on their direction. And so this is something that seismologists can measure, and it actually tells us something very direct about the way the mantle is flowing. It's a very neat technique. So if you want to understand kind of how mantle flow and mantle convection works today beneath the North American continent. We can measure this seismic anisotropy. And
okay,
it gives
so
us...
Let's go back to
yes,
the basics. So
absolutely.
The mantle is constantly moving.
Yep, absolutely. So just, you know, the kind of cartoon picture of mantle convection that you, you know, sort of would see in a textbook. You know, so we know that the mantle is moving. It's moving very slowly. You know, it's a couple of centimeters a year, maybe. So it's definitely slow on human timescales. And we know that this is happening, but it's very difficult to observe because it's happening slowly. So seismology gives us techniques that we can use to actually measure the direction of mantle flow.
So when you say that waves move at different speeds in different directions,
mm-hmm.
is that a constant thing? Like waves moving north always go more slowly than waves moving south?
Well, it depends on where you are. So in different regions of the United States, that direction is different. And that's telling you, so in, you know, out in the western U.S., in a lot of places, we see that the fast direction of wave propagation is about east-west, and that's telling us something. And then you go to other regions of the continent, and that direction is different. So it really actually gives us a way to map out how the mantle is moving.
And so the entire mantle is not moving in one direction
exactly.
as a mass.
Nope.
It's moving in all
it's
sorts
moving,
of different directions.
Yep, and there are a bunch of, you know, different geologic processes that control that. So out in the western U.S., we have the subduction, the Cascadia subduction zone, where the Juan de Fuca tectonic plate is diving beneath North America, and that's why we have the Cascades volcanoes and all kinds of, you know, volcanic activity out in the western U.S. And that the subduction of that plate is really, you know, controlling the mantle flow field out beneath North America. And that's actually something that we've really discovered using USRA data, using Earthscope data.
So why should anybody outside of a scientist intensely interested in this question care about which direction the mantle is
great
moving?
Great question. Great question. It's the kind of thing that sort of sounds academic. There's actually a lot of geologic activity that we know has happened in the fairly recent past. But oftentimes it's a puzzle as to why it's happened. So let me give you an example. One example, out in the western U.S., we have the Columbia River flood basalts, and we have the Yellowstone hotspot track. And so we have all, so these are all regions that have undergone volcanic activity over the last 17 million years, which to a geologist is very recent. And we don't, so we've seen, you know, the Columbia River flood basalts in particular, you know, a huge area about the size of the state of Oregon was covered in kilometers of basalt volcanic flows, magma flows. And so there was this massive outpouring of volcanic activity in the Pacific Northwest. And it's been a little bit of a puzzle as to what exactly happened in the mantle to make this volcanic activity happen at the surface. So there are a lot of examples of geologic processes that we know have happened in the past or sometimes are happening today, and we don't always know why. And knowing what's happening with the mantle, how the mantle is flowing, and what those patterns of mantle flow look like can help us to solve some of those puzzles. So there's been a lot of work looking at Yellowstone volcanics and the Snake River Plain, which is sort of in the region of Yellowstone, as well as some volcanics in eastern Oregon, and trying to look at what the mantle flow field looks like today beneath those regions to help us solve the puzzle of why are these volcanoes here. So it actually does help us to understand some of the geologic processes that we see.
So how does the transportable array data, what does that give you that you wouldn't get from the global seismic array that's already out there?
Yep, absolutely. So it's if you want to study processes, sort of you know, regional processes, if you want to look at the North American continent and say, I want to know what's happening under here, you really need to have stations in that region. And with Earthscope, with USRA, you know, we went from having really very sparse instrumentation, very sparse locations of seismometers, to all of a sudden having this huge, dense data set. So it's like, you know, if you had an astronomer who was using binoculars to study astronomy, and then you took away her binoculars and you handed her a really great telescope. And now all of a sudden she can see things in much greater detail, and everything that looked fuzzy gets clear. And that's really what has happened with having the transportable array data for us. It, you know, we went from having a really crude pair of binoculars to having a really great telescope that now we can sort of point towards the Earth's interior.
Are there questions or surprises that have come up along the way in looking at this data that you didn't expect to address or to see?
Yeah, absolutely. There have been a lot of features that have come out of the data that were unexpected. One kind of good example is, you know, and again, this is sort of out in the western U.S., sort of unexpectedly, scientists looked at images of seismic wave speeds in the Earth's interior. And this is, it's actually just like medical tomography. So it's just like doing a CT scan of somebody's brain. We can actually do that using seismic waves. And so we can map out regions of the mantle that are particularly fast for seismic wave propagation and particularly slow. And rather unexpectedly, there was a discovery of a region of particularly fast material beneath the central part of Nevada, and it actually coincides with a region where this seismic anisotropy indicator, so the direction of mantle flow, also looks very, very different from what's around it. And the one of the interpretations of this is that we actually have what's known as a lithospheric drip, so a piece of the mantle lithosphere, so the part of the mantle that's right beneath the crust, we think is actually dripping off down into the mantle and sort of falling off the base of the continent. Now, this happens over very, you know, long geologic timescales, but it was an example of a feature that we really didn't expect to see, but the data sort of revealed it. So there have been several examples like that of kind of unexpected discoveries that have come out from the transportable array data. And this helps us to understand the geology that we see around us. You know, it's important from the perspective of understanding geologic hazards, understanding earthquakes. You know, here on the East Coast, where we just had magnitude 5.8 earthquake in Virginia, unexpected. You know, we don't expect to necessarily have large earthquakes here. You know, if we can understand and make these unexpected discoveries about what's going on deep in the earth, it helps us to understand the geology that we see around us.
And clearly, this kind of project is not something that any one laboratory or investigator could possibly ever fund.
Absolutely. And from the point of view of an individual scientist, this is, you know, as you said, it's way more ambitious than any individual scientist or even group of scientists could do. So the seismology community is really, you know, amazingly lucky that we have this large project and large data collection effort that gives us this amazing data set to work with.
It's like Christmas every day.
It's like Christmas every day. It's better than Christmas.
Maureen Long, thank you.
Thank you.
While at the reception, I also caught up with USARRAY Project Director Dr. Bob Woodard and Dr. Michael Hedlund from UC San Diego's Laboratory for Atmospheric Acoustics. Hedlund is another scientist who's built an unexpected research project, in this case using the transportable seismic array to look both down into the Earth and up into the atmosphere. It turns out Hedlund and Woodard went to graduate school together and struck up a friendship based around Woodard's skill as a car mechanic.
Another talent.
You had a Volkswagen Beetle that needed a lot of fixing.
I had a Beetle that needed work, and Bob was the go-to guy to get it fixed. Yeah, he has not well known that he's a good mechanic.
Do your mechanical skills come in handy with transportable arrays?
Yeah, maybe they do. Yeah, so I'm based in Washington, D.C., and sometimes when things need, I wouldn't say fixing, but need, you know, you're dealing with things when something's off plan, or you're trying to get things kind of straightened out and trying to plan things. And so there's some troubleshooting sometimes involved. Yeah.
So I'm curious, from the Washington, D.C. end of things, what does it take to get a $90 million project that whose applications don't necessarily jump out at the average person. What does it take to get the government support for that?
Wow. Yeah. You know, it took a long time initially, and that was before I joined the project. But it took a lot of people with a real vision and a real passion to describe the whole science and what they thought would come out of the science and really advocate for the project. And then it took people on the more technical side of the project to help develop the plans that showed that it was within reach. Although I think at the time, the plans contained a lot of stretch. I mean, it really wasn't clear that it could be done, but for the National Science Foundation, that's part of the attraction, is doing a science project that's just right on, you know, right at the limits of what can be done. And so I think it was the mix of those two things, kind of the potential for the science, the passion about the science, and then being able to put together a project plan that showed that it was at least feasible and could be done.
Well, it seems like at this point it's not only shown that it's feasible, but that there are a lot of really unexpected, interesting things we can learn from it. And projects, I don't know if this is a lofty comparison or not, but projects like Hubble, where it goes out to do one mission, and at the end of its mission, we find out we've learned so much more from it that maybe we need to extend the mission. And talking with Bob Busby, he's talking about going to Alaska, maybe going across the Atlantic. Do you see a prosperous future for the transportable array?
Yeah, well, you know, even if not for us specifically, I think that the whole concept has been picked up by other countries, other groups. So there are a number of other places in the world. In China, there's a program called China Array that's modeled very closely on U.S. Array. There's talk about a project in India. And so in other countries, looking at trying to do similar projects. So I think that the legacy of the project, I think the TA itself, of course, is, you know, the plan is to go to Alaska and do that. And who knows after that. But then I think these other projects inspired by the transportable array will continue to have an enormous impact. And I think the comparison to the Hubble is apropos. You know, it's a project where collect a tremendous amount of data very systematically in kind of a survey mode. And so, you know, a lot of science is done where you have a very specific hypothesis you're setting out to test, and you design the experiment very closely around that hypothesis. Something that was different about the transportable array was kind of saying, well, an element of this, there clearly were hypotheses to be tested. There were a number. But there was also an element that just said, we will systematically collect very high-quality data and make it completely open, and curious, phenomenally talented science community will use that data and do things that no one ever anticipated. And that's what's happened. That's been one of the real successes of the project, is the science that we didn't even anticipate when the proposal was written.
Oftentimes that more exploratory survey mode kind of science, I think it's a little bit of a bad rap. It gets kind of second billing to the hypothesis-driven, we have an experiment to go and do. But you're saying that, in fact, we really need that just purely survey exploration, because we can't necessarily predict what the right hypotheses are.
That's right. That's right. So you know there are broad questions out there, but sometimes until you've started to see the data, you don't even know what the questions are. I mean, that's what's been interesting about it, is some of the questions kind of manifested after people started looking at the data. But it is harder to justify that, to say, well, we're going to go out and we're going to collect really good data, and we trust that curious, talented people will dig into that and they will make discoveries. And so it's a little bit more of a leap of faith, but it's really paid off. And in fact, Michael is one of the people that's doing work that was completely unanticipated when we originally deployed the array.
So Michael, tell us a little bit about what you've been doing with US Array data.
Well, I thought your question to Bob about the mission of the U.S. Array expanded beyond what was originally intended. It was very appropriate, because that is, as Bob said, that's exactly what we've been doing. So the transportable array was designed, it's initially a seismic network that was designed for study of the solid Earth interior and sources within the Earth. But it turns out that when there are waves in the atmosphere, what we call infrasound, these long period waves in the atmosphere that are just like seismic waves in the solid earth, but they happen to travel through the atmosphere. When they come back to the ground, they shake the ground slightly, and these seismometers are so sensitive that they pick those signals up as well. So we found out that we had all these really slow-moving signals in the seismic database just from things that are happening in the atmosphere, whether it's say, a coal mine explosion, or whether it's a large tornadic storm or waves at the ocean. There's all sorts of sources in the atmosphere that are causing sound waves that are moving slowly, but they're crossing the ground, and they're being recorded by the transportable arrays. So we kind of came along and knew this. This wasn't really a new finding. We knew from many years ago that seismometers would record the atmosphere, but the TA comes along with this incredible density of stations over a very large area, and suddenly we're seeing signals that are being recorded at really small station offsets, and so we can really see these signals evolve away from the source, and that's been immensely helpful to us to understand how sound travels long distances over the transportable array. So after this initial observation, with some works with Earthscope, Bob Busby, who you've talked to already, I believe, he spearheaded the addition of air pressure sensors onto the network to start to convert it to a kind of a hybrid network that records pressure in the atmosphere as well as the seismic data. And then a colleague of mine at UCSD, Frank Vernon, and I wrote a proposal that was funded through an MRI with the National Science Foundation to add more pressure sensors and higher frequency microphones to all of the sites in the transportable array. And so now what we have is a broadband seismoacoustic observatory from what was originally designed as a seismic network. So the capabilities of the network really has expanded, and now we can study phenomena in the atmosphere as well as solid earth and how the atmosphere and solid earth interact.
How much of a boon to your research is this array?
Huge, because so in the field of infrasound, which again is a study of low frequency sound waves in the atmosphere, we were able to, because of nuclear monitoring, a global network was designed and built called the International Monitoring System Infrasound Network. That network has 60 arrays or 60 collections of sensors around the whole world. So that's an unprecedented data set. It was great. We can do research with that, even though it's really designed for nuclear monitoring. It's been good for research, but still the distances between the stations are so enormous that it's really difficult to infer what's happening in detail from such sparse data. So the transportable array comes along, places the station every 70 kilometers, and it fills wherever the TA is. It fills huge gaps in the infrasound coverage that just fills it in. We can just see how one signal at one IMS infrasound array connects to a signal at another IMS infrasound array. It fills in all the gaps, and so it's just an entirely different way of doing research in low-frequency atmospheric acoustics. It's a dense network. This is the new approach versus the sparse global network of infrasound arrays, which is really the opposite way of doing the research. So it's really changed the game.
Bob Woodward, thank you. And Michael Hedlund, thank you.
You're very welcome.
I spoke with Bob Woodward, Michael Hedlund, Maureen Long, and Bob Busby at a reception celebrating 10 years of the U.S. Array program. More Living Lab after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. When you think about school science fair projects, you might think of baking soda volcanoes or styrofoam models of the planets. More to the point, that's what a lot of students think of and what they enter in science fairs. But to a lot of real scientists, projects like that are a missed opportunity. They say that rather than just building models, children as young as 8 or 10 can do actual science and discover new things. Adam Hochberg reports.
When 14-year-old Kyle Gazzillo was getting ready for this year's school science fair in Dalton, Massachusetts, he had a pretty good idea what he wanted to enter.
I was hoping to combine inside a bottle baking soda and vinegar and seeing which ones explode the best.
Of course, it's easy to understand why teenagers gravitate toward projects that explode. Those baking soda rockets and baking soda volcanoes are old standards at science fairs, so popular that you'll find more than 100 videos on YouTube of kids making them. But the more Kyle thought about building effervescent bottle bombs, the less excited he became.
That's something a lot of people know how to do. It's just messy and looks cool. It has no science behind it besides the reaction with baking soda and vinegar or whatever you want to mix.
So by the time we met them at the Massachusetts State Science and Engineering Fair, Kyle and his research partner, Owen Alabozic, were showing off a very different experiment.
We did our project on standing and sitting, how it affects your memory.
Yeah, because when I study, I tend to like to stand, and maybe I was wondering if that affected people. And it did. Standing improved most people's memory.
That new project, one the eighth graders thought of themselves, earned third place in the state finals. And it's the kind of thing the fair's executive director, Cora Beth Abel, wants to see more of. Original research that relates to students' own lives, rather than demonstrations they copy from the internet or from books.
When students own their research, they care about it, and especially when it relates to the world around them. That student really gets excited and inspired in a way that reading a textbook just can't do.
The Massachusetts Fair has promoted that so-called inquiry-based science for years. But when it comes to the smaller fairs that local schools might hold, projects still often lean toward the familiar standbys.
When my daughter had a science fair, what she came home with was the idea to demonstrate something we already know.
That's North Carolina State University biologist Rob Dunn. He helps write a blog about bugs and microbes called Your Wildlife. Lately, he's been on a crusade to improve science fairs that started when his second-grade daughter showed him a list of suggested projects.
The standard sheet of paper had volcanoes. It had lots and lots of beans. You could do a collection of leaves. But what nobody was telling these kids is that even as second graders, they can do science that produces results to questions we don't know the answer to.
Dunn says most kids don't realize there are a lot of questions like that. So on their blog, Dunn and his colleague, Holly Menninger, asked readers to suggest projects that allow young people to do real science. They got more than 100 ideas.
So what do ants do when it rains? What do spiders in our house eat? What effect does the please pick up after your dog sign actually have on the removal of dog poop from a community?
Those projects focus on things kids see every day and could even yield some new information. But Menninger concedes they also involve something of a leap of faith, because unlike exploding bottles, original projects can have unpredictable results, or no useful results at all.
This happens to scientists all the time, too, that your hypothesis could have been wrong, and I think that's great. I think that sometimes some of the most exciting discoveries are the things that we don't anticipate.
But who wins a grand prize in a science fair with an experiment that doesn't come up with a result? We want something that goes boom or makes a lot of mold. Those are the ones that win the prizes.
I mean, that's a culture change, I think, sort of steering people away from the final product and focusing more on the process.
Menninger says a lot of kids are ready to do that. The bigger challenge is getting buy-in from adults.
I just have probably the shortest slideshow in the world, I hope.
At Western Carolina University, biology professor Kevin Catley manages a regional science fair and leads these workshops to prepare teachers for it. He says some adults make the fairs worse, parents who do the work for their children, or teachers who provide little guidance.
There's no question in my mind that 80% of the teachers that routinely do a science fair are not competent themselves, and this is no criticism, this is a critique of their educational experience because they've had no research background. So they find it very difficult to advise students, and the quality is pretty bad.
Catley says there's no quick fix for what he calls cookie-cutter science fairs. He says it will take better training for teachers and more support for science in general. But at fairs that have changed their culture, you can see the difference.
And next we have from Taunton High School,
as the prizes were handed out at the Massachusetts Fair, the winners ranged from complex projects that studied topics like gene mutation to simple things like a student who found a way to make fluffier cupcakes. What the winners had in common is that they were fresh, scientifically sound, and potentially useful. And there wasn't a baking soda rocket among the bunch. I'm Adam Hochberg.
That story was produced as part of the STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. And that's our show. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. Connect with Living Lab Radio anytime on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.